Hey there, welcome to the Damage Report. I'm Brooke Thomas, sitting in here with J.R. Jackson today.
Yeah.
J.R. Thursdays, J.R. Friday Eves.
I think we should float this and see what the people really want.
Yeah.
Should it be J.R. Tuesday? I mean, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Producer extraordinaire, Sophie Tice, she said that we look like the Fairly Odd Parents. And while there was shade, lots of shade in that, there was a lot of truth too, because we looked up their picture.
Yep.
And we are kind of,
because I had no idea why the reference was made, and I remembered that show.
Right.
But also, I mean, the thing is Sophie should look out, because what people don't want are black folks taking the roles of fictional characters that were previously white. That'll be
a problem. Right. Her Twitter account's gonna get fired up.
Don't
people
tweet
are gonna
that.
Be like, "Don't you dare take our fairies from us." All right, so we have a lot going on today. We're talking about the debate, and I know you were probably debated out.
Mm-hmm.
So we're keeping it short.
Really?
A couple things. Excellent. We're going to talk about. I'm dying to have your opinion on that. We're also talking about Donald Trump and asylum. We've got David Dennis Jr. He's going to be live talking news of the day.
Always
lots
good
of
to talk
news,
to David.
News to touch on a pretty wild video that I want to show you out of Oklahoma, my home state. And I wonder where you're going to sit on this, but I feel like people may be surprised where I sit on this. They shouldn't be if they really know me, but you might be. So let's get right to it. Let's just jump right in.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because last night's debate, I would say it was pretty combative. Would you say that?
Yeah, it was targeted.
Uh-huh.
You could tell. I mean, from CNN's moderators' questions all the way down to the what other candidates, specifically Bill de Blasio,
what they looked
to do was to target certain folks, and it automatically made it that way. Yeah.
But speaking of their questions, a lot of people were happy. I noticed that the questions seemed to center on issues that are. Important that largely affect black and brown people, mm-hmm. which is something that I don't think I've ever seen at a debate so much. And so that was nice
It was
to see.
So if this is what I think those types of things set up for. It's mm-hmm. it's good to hear, because candidates generally don't talk about those things.
Right.
But then once they do, you get so much criticism from conservatives, Republican circles, that's why they shy away from it so much. And maybe this is an indication that they're not really going to buy into that fear anymore of saying, how dare you speak about policies and agendas that can benefit black and brown people in this country, because that's biased, or that's identity politics or pandering to those voting blocks. Why is it when you're doing policies towards the Wall Street community, bankers, corporations, the richest of the rich, tax cuts to rich, that's what Republicans ran on. Why is that not pandering?
That's true. Pander to me, though, please. Finally,
yeah,
we'll take it, right?
Because there's an anger with giving certain folks that have always been disenfranchised respect. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get right into it. Because speaking of criticism, Joe Biden, you know, there was, and this makes sense. A lot of kind of the top ranked so far candidates were, and a lot of them have issues that they need to answer to. So mm-hmm. it wasn't wrongly directed, but you could tell people are trying to get attention.
Yeah,
and that seemed to be a good strategy for a lot of people. So Joe Biden, he was asked to answer to a lot of things. One big topic, former President Obama's immigration record. And so specifically, he was asked, you know, about the millions of deportations that happened while he was vice president, while President Obama was president, and if he did anything about it. So he answered, and he sort of defended President Obama's record, saying that he moved to fundamentally change the system, which in large parts he did.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't enough for de Blasio, mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio. He wanted more, and he specifically pushed him, you know, asking him if he spoke out against those deportations. Take a look.
I asked the vice president point blank, did he use his power to stop those deportations? He went right around the question. Mr. Vice President, you want to be president of the United States. You need to be able to answer the tough questions. I guarantee you, if you're debating Donald Trump, he's not going to let you off the hook. So did you say those deportations were a good idea? Or did you go to the president and say, this is a mistake, we shouldn't do it? Which one?
I was vice president. I am not the president. I keep my recommendation in private. Unlike you, I expect you would go ahead and say whatever was said privately with him. That's not what I do. What I do say to you is he moved to fundamentally change the system. That's what he did. That's what he did. But much more has to be done. Much more has to be done.
I still don't hear an answer.
Senator Booker, please respond.
Well, a couple things. First of all,
Mr. Vice President, you can't have it both ways. You invoke President Obama more than anybody in this campaign. You can't do it when it's convenient right. and then dodge it when it's not.
Yeah.
That was the part that made me go, oh, like, it's true.
And it's tough to fight a battle amongst several fronts. Because right. once you finish, by the way, that was, I think, the third time that that Joe Biden was trying not to fully answer the question of what he said and what mm-hmm. he did. And it's, in a way, because of his position, he came in as a front runner because he was the vice president under the last Democratic president. So because of that, you're going to come and have an answer to those questions. And in a way, they're kind of impossible to answer because no matter what, you're going to look bad. So you have one of two options. You don't answer it like he kind of did, or you answer it and your only answer is, well, no, I didn't speak up against it, which I think was the truth. I didn't speak up against the mass deportations that the Obama administration was pulling off. And then you look bad. It's a soundbite. It's in someone's ad now. Mm-hmm. Or you say, yeah, I did speak up, and President Obama ignored me. Then like, oh my God, Joe Biden cuts President Obama. And you can't do any of those things.
You can't do any of those things.
So you're set up to be in a bad situation. That's what happens when you're in that position. That's just what it is.
So de Blasio cornered him pretty well there. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say cornered him as if it wasn't a good question mm-hmm. that a lot of people want to hear answers about. But then you see de Blasio kind of on another side, kind of on the defense.
Yeah.
When we bring up Eric Garner. A lot of last night's debate had to do with different aspects of our criminal justice system, mm-hmm. the death penalty, other types of reforms that need to happen. A lot of the people on the stage, their history with criminal justice, mm-hmm. and specifically one topic that a lot of people had something to say about and wanted to jump in about, I saw that everyone was kind of wanting to talk about that. It was the death of Eric Garner and why the police officer who killed him is still on the force. Here is what Mayor Bill de Blasio had to say.
Why is that police officer still on the force, the one who killed Eric Garner? Please respond.
Let me tell you, I know the Garner family. They've gone through extraordinary pain. They are waiting for justice, and they're going to get justice. There's finally going to be justice. I have confidence in that in the next 30 days in New York. You know why? Because for the first time, we are not waiting on the federal Justice Department, which told the city of New York that we could not proceed because the Justice Department was pursuing their prosecution. And years went by, and a lot of pain accrued. And in the meantime, what I'm working on is making sure, and I have for 5 years, there will never be another tragedy. There'll never be another Eric Garner because we're changing fundamentally how we police.
Was that response adequate? Please respond.
No, he should be fired. He should be fired now.
That was the
straight up. Okay, yeah. So the hard part is, well, it's not really the hard part. But when you have some things you haven't tied up, we're speaking of Bill de Blasio now, you haven't tied up from your own record as being the mayor, and then you come after someone else. This is the problem. Every politician is going to have some things that they did.
Every single one on that stage, absolutely.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then, so the best approach is how do you deal with it? I mean, what at the other debate, Buttigieg had to talk about what was going on with his police department mm-hmm. in South Bend. And a lot of people liked it because he said, yeah, I messed up. My fault. I haven't done anything much for this whole situation. But what didn't come, at least in my mind, was how are you going to make it better,
yeah.
starting right now?
I liked Buttigieg's answer, too. I felt like mm-hmm. that was honest. It was great. Mm-hmm. It also showed me that he's not ready
yeah.
to leave yep. this country.
So there's two aspects of that. Mm-hmm. And in this one, Bill de Blasio decided not to do the part of saying, or not to accept any of the responsibility he has to this day for not firing that cop. It has nothing to do with the Department of Justice and whether or not they're going to bring charges. That has nothing to do with being fired. I mentioned this last night. If a kid gets into a fight and he works at a McDonald's, not even a kid, 25-year-old works at a McDonald's, gets into a fight over the weekend, comes back and work, and he'd been arrested for a brawl he got into, McDonald's isn't going to wait for the charges to come down before they say, yeah, we don't think you should be working here anymore.
Right.
And that's a McDonald's job, right? But you're the mayor. And this police officer who has the ability to kill people and apparently get away with it is still on the force because the Department of Justice hasn't come down and brought forward formal charges. Or now that they haven't, that means he's testing the political waters.
It's absolutely what it means. And I think that there's a couple things going on here. You touched on something great, that everyone on that stage has issues that they're going to have to answer mm-hmm. to. They have failed in some way. Everybody on that stage, absolutely. A lot of the problems is that some of them are building on those failures without acknowledging them.
Right.
And so he's saying that for the first time, we're not waiting for the feds, but you have been waiting for 5 years, and you haven't even spoken out against it. And also, on what, kind of touching back on what Cory Booker said to Biden, you know, you can't have it both ways. The last debate, he stood there and kind of, it was a huge moment for him talking about how his son, who is black, you know, he's a black kid, he's got an afro, his son faces the issues that a lot of other black men face from police departments across the country. And, you know, you had people saying that was really powerful. He understands it. And you have people saying, one, Cory Booker, who's standing right next to you, he understands it too. Two, that's your police department. Right now, that is your police department. And at the very least, why haven't we seen you do what Gillibrand just did right there and just say it needs to be fired? Maybe your hands are tied. Many don't believe they are, but you haven't even said anything strong. Just even that answer, you know, why is he still on the force? And it was like, oh, in the next 30 days, it's been 5 years. And you have acknowledged that this is a problem.
And then went on to ask Joe Biden why he didn't nudge the Department of Justice under the Obama administration to bring forward those charges, because it occurred during the Obama administration. So when you bring that up, you're bringing up someone else's responsibility to do something about it, but you still haven't answered about yours. And this is where people's anecdotal stories about their kid, I have a black kid, why they bother me, because I need them to connect to me why that makes a difference. If you just have a black kid and you leave it hanging there, you think we're just stupid. So after you say you have a black kid and you understand the predicament he may be in, apparently you didn't, because you haven't done anything about someone else's black kid who was murdered, and you didn't appear to connect to that. People jumped on President Obama's back when he said Trayvon could have been my son. Oh, how could you say such a thing? He's saying it because he understands why it's a problem here. Now, if you say I have a black son, I get it, but then you don't do anything actionable about it, do you get it? Actions work for me. I don't care about apologies necessarily. I don't care about your statement of what you're going to do until you do it.
Yeah. All right, coming up, we've got more debate to talk about. And do you know who the most Googled candidate was last night? Coming up, I'll tell you and show you a major reason why. Stay with us.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard was Google's most searched candidate in all 50 states last night after the debate. It was a hot night for her. It was a good night for her. It was a big night for her. Much of the talk about her centered around an interaction between her and Senator Kamala Harris. She pressed Harris on her criminal justice record. Take a look.
Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California. And she fought to keep cash bail system in place that impacts poor people in the worst kind of way.
So we were just kind of talking throughout that, the reasoning, like she would say things that are absolutely true. Two things happening here, and I don't think it, one, as the lead prosecutor in the state, you don't prosecute every single case. Mm-hmm. And so it's weird for me that it's kind of talked as if she was in that courtroom every single time. But I also think that as lead prosecutor, every single case is your responsibility, and there could have been tighter oversight.
Yeah, you get the name recognition for having the position, so you also get like, the blame of things you're wrong. Right, yeah.
But so then like the reasonings on some of those were, she was making
for,
stuff up.
In order to make sure you have cheap labor for the state.
Like where did that come from?
Because that's what, it's a natural result of the policy of keeping people longer, not necessarily the intended reasoning for it. So
right.
So you can presume and put that on top because that is what happens, right? That's what happens in debates. Now, this is what we were mentioning before we even got to this was I was surprised. I also mentioned this last night. I was surprised that Kamala Harris wasn't prepared for this. The same way
it seemed like she was not. Yes.
Joe Biden wasn't prepared for her coming at him for the busing or his criminal justice background record or the crime bill he'd been a part of that he's been touting his entire career. I'm still not sure how you're not ready yet. Now, again, I said this last night, too. Mm-hmm. Kamala needs to go ahead and look up. You know, it's really simple. They're handled by so many people. You have, as we mentioned before, a lot of these candidates have issues. You might want to go on Twitter, find out what people are saying about you, mm-hmm. and it's backed up with your history because you lived it, and be prepared to talk about it because I don't know if we're going to get to Kamala's response. Are we?
We are, yeah, absolutely.
Because this is what she does. Instead.
So, well, so she responded a little bit, I guess, in that moment, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not going to have that, but she did respond a little bit in that moment. And as you alluded to, it didn't seem like she was prepared for Tulsi Gabbard to come at her. Mm-hmm. So after the debate, she had a little time to breathe, and she had a bit of a stronger answer. Okay, watch this.
As the elected Attorney General of California, I did the work of significantly reforming the criminal justice system of a state of 40 million people, which became a national model for the work that needs to be done. And I am proud of that work. And I am proud of making a decision to not just give fancy speeches or be in a legislative body and give speeches on the floor, but actually doing the work of being in the position to use the power that I had to reform a system that is badly in need of reform. That is why we created initiatives that were about reentering former offenders and getting them counseling. Why and because I know that criminal justice
Thank
system
you,
is
Senator.
So broken that I am an advocate for what
Thank
we
you,
need
Senator.
To do to not
your
only decriminalize but legalize marijuana in the United States.
I want to bring Congresswoman Gabbard back in. Your response.
The bottom line is, Senator Harris, when you are in a position to make a difference and an impact in these people's lives, you did not. And worse yet, in the case of those who were on death row, innocent people, you actually blocked evidence from being revealed that would have freed them until you were forced to do so. There is no excuse for that. And the people who suffered under your reign as prosecutor, you owe them an apology.
All right, so pair that with what Senator Harris said after she had a little bit more time after the debate. Take a look.
This coming from someone who has been an apologist for an individual, Assad, who has murdered the people of his country to like cockroaches. She who has embraced and been an apologist for him in a way that she refuses to call him a war criminal. I can only take what she says in her opinion so seriously.
Okay, so this is the first part of it. During the debate, her first being Kamala Harris's first response was, uh-huh. What you're saying is inaccurate, and it goes into other things that she may have done that are more positive. So I guess it's a good political approach to do on this type of thing, but I guess people who are really analyzing and care of the details about what Tulsi Gabbard brought up, mm-hmm. you can see that as a bit of a dodge. So then she goes on in the Anderson Cooper, I think she was talking
about. Yeah,
right?
It was like the post.
Got a chance to actually fire back at Tulsi Gabbard and her record, some of the things that she's done. As we've said before, all these candidates have some things that we can criticize from their past. I guess it depends on who you're talking to, because I think overall it's going to work out okay for her, not well, but okay, being Kamala.
Oh, yeah.
Because the majority of people are going to see all that and hear it and then go, but yeah, but she really talked for another minute about how the good things that she's done. And it's a good strategy, but I wish these politicians would actually directly confront the things that are being brought up to them. Say, yeah, you know what, those were mistakes. Mm-hmm. Say it. Because then now the people who know those were mistakes and know that it happened are going, why won't you say that was a mistake? Just say it. And then move on to the good things you did.
I think that that's a good statement to take us right into Tulsi Gabbard responding to the accusation that she is an Assad apologist. Watch this.
I think it's unfortunate and a disservice to voters in this country that she resorts to cheap smears rather than actually addressing her record, the issues that I've raised, and the fact that she said she is proud of this record. If that's the case, then voters deserve to hear about why she's so proud of the lives that she has negatively impacted, the families that she's torn apart in California.
Again. So you can talk about how she didn't answer the question, which was the valid, mostly 70% of that discussion. Mm-hmm. The first 25%, you can say, this is where I've stood on Assad. Maybe it was a mistake. Maybe she doesn't believe that. So that's the first problem.
Right. Has she ever said that she made mistakes? No. I don't think so. She didn't there.
No. But then if you're going to say it's a smear, at least say why it's a smear, say why it's inaccurate. Because they both said what each other is saying about them is inaccurate. Uh-huh. It can't all be inaccurate.
Right.
Because it's all easily researchable. So you have a couple folks, and Biden included, he did the same thing. You don't want to talk about what someone brought up. You try to shift it. That's the political strategy with this. And people who watch closely like us don't buy it. But the sad thing is, this strategy of deflecting and moving on to other things works for both Kamala, Tulsi, and Joe.
Yeah. All right, coming up next, we've got David Dennis Jr. live talking about a bunch of different topics, like Ronald Reagan's a racist. Duh. We'll be right back. Hey there, welcome back to The Damage Report. Me, Brooke Thomas, J.R. Jackson, John Adarola. I don't think we've mentioned John all show long. That's weird, just it's his show. His name is behind me. John's out for the week, but he will be back. And super happy to be here Monday.
John has gone to a nerd convention. I won't say which one, but he's gone to a convention. After the Detroit debates, he decided to have some good old fun at a convention.
He needed to nerd out a little bit more. Yeah, so that's okay. That's John for you. All right, Ronald Reagan's racism is nothing new to many people, a lot many people. But a newly released phone call recording from October of 1971, even so, is still jarring to many. We're going to listen to that recording, and then we're going to bring in our very special guest, David Dennis Jr. He is senior culture editor at News One. So let's take a listen to the audio first.
And last night I tell you to watch that thing on television as I did.
Yeah.
To see those monkeys from those African countries. Damn them, they're still uncomfortable wearing shoes.
All right, let's bring in David Dennis Jr., senior culture editor of News One. David, good morning. Thanks for being here with us.
Good morning.
All right, so it's hard to tell in that audio, but that is former President Ronald Reagan. He wasn't president at the time. It was before he was president. Mm-hmm. He was governor of California at the time. He was on the phone with a very joyful, the current president at the time, Richard Nixon. And you could hear Reagan say, he called African people monkeys and said they looked uncomfortable wearing shoes. He was upset because Tanzania, I think, sided with China on the UN vote to recognize the People's Republic of China. What were your thoughts when you heard this?
I'm not surprised. Like you said, Ronald Reagan has a long history of racism. Black folks across this country are not surprised by this. It is sort of vindicating that, you know, over the last 20 or so years, Ronald Reagan has become this celebrated president. This beacon of civility, especially when you talk about the Republican Party, they talk about going back to the days of Reagan. But for African Americans in this country, that is not really a great thing. I mean, you think about Reagan, you think about somebody who did not care take it lightly about drugs into black communities, who do not, who saw the AIDS epidemic as something that was for the LGBT community and for, African folks. He didn't seem to care about it. So but for years, black people have been saying, like, this is the Ronald Reagan that we all knew. And so this recording has taken some people by surprise. But for, black folks in this country, it's not surprising at all.
David, so as to add to that list, also the welfare queens line, which actually Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez mentioned earlier this year, how Reagan used that to divide black folks from other working class people at the time to make sure that the hate was strong. And she caught a bit of hell for it. So first off, just to add with that, I want to add that aspect of some of the things that he did. What have you seen? You said some people were surprised. What have you seen from many supporters or potential supporters for Reagan and the Republican Party as he's their, you know, their deity? Has there been much response? Because I've been kind of looking, I haven't been looking as hard because we had the debate stuff yesterday. Has there been a response? Is there any defense to this or just plain ignoring it?
No, I haven't seen much defense. I think that there's been a everybody is enjoying the circus that was the Democratic debates last night. And so they're kind of shifting their focus there. I would imagine that the Republican Party is relieved that Ronald Reagan didn't have a Twitter account back then, because this would probably have been out on the internet, you know, if he's anything like our current president.
Let's go there. Our current president.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? What's interesting to me, though, before we even go there, because as we're talking, this is nothing new. But you still have a lot of people who consider themselves, you know, great people, and they're, you know, conservative people, and they are the party of Reagan. They are Reagan conservatives. And you see people saying this every day. The president had to be fact-checked because he reposted this weird meme that someone made of a fake quote of Reagan. But essentially, he was happy at this quote that implied that, you know, Reagan was proud of him and called him a future president, and he was bragging about that. And we've seen this kind of this space of people again calling themselves Reagan conservatives when there is so much evidence of Reagan's racism. Why do you think that is, and will this do anything? Will this change that? Because this is
No, I don't think this will change anything. I mean, you know, Reagan's racism has always been there if you dig deep enough into it. So, you know, but if you're thinking about the Republican Party, I mean, you know, how many of their heroes don't have any sort of racist history? Or if you think about politics in general, really in America, I mean, you look at people who have to reckon with their past and their present of racism and, you know, the way black folks are treated. So this is nothing new. And, you know, last time we talked about the party line between direct line of, you know, from the Republicans to Trump, and Reagan is part of that line. I mean, the welfare queen all the way to, you know, George Bush inciting race by putting ads out for, you know, the black predators when he was trying to get elected. I mean, if you go even to the Democratic Party and the discussion of super predators, and you go to Trump, I mean, the things that are happening now are not much different. I mean, what's that different between talking about people in Africa and talking about, you know, S-hole countries like Donald Trump did? I mean, this is the same exact rhetoric just 30 years later.
So we mentioned earlier about how this isn't, it is not sticking because of the news of the day or the debate of the day. Mm-hmm. What's the approach that you think a lot of news, I guess, entities and outlets will make? Will they try to keep this up, or is this one of those things where like, oh, well, it didn't really stick, it's not really happening, it's old news, even though 1971 is when it happened, it was old news yesterday, but it was actually new news. Is there an approach that news entities can take? Because this is one of those things. I remember when Trump was tweeting his racist things, and then I think CNN even said, this is going to be a bad. Oh no, I'm sorry. It was the Epstein situation with his labor secretary. He goes, this is going to be bad if this stays in the news. If it doesn't stay in the news, Trump is going to move on from it. How does this stay in the news? Is it possible?
Well, it stays in the news by the news organizations themselves keeping it in the news. I mean, the problem is for so long we've let Donald Trump dictate what is news and what is not news. He sends out a tweet and we shift and we run behind him when that's not necessarily the role of the media. The media is really there to tell the actual story of what's going on. And what is the story here is that we have a president, a former president who has been lauded, who has been celebrated as the example of what being a presidential human being should look like, and he is a stone cold racist. Now, a lot of the media needs to look within themselves and figure out why they have not been able to address Ronald Reagan's racism for all this time, nor have they been able to call out any politicians, anybody running for office who evokes Reagan as some sort of beacon of the way politics are supposed to be run. This is on the media to address this, to call this what it is. And it is point blank, straight up racism.
And speaking of calling it what it is, we just had this conversation when President Trump initially started attacking Congressman Elijah Cummings in a horribly racist attack that people still had trouble. And we talked about that. We broke down why it's important to call it what it is and be honest and truthful as journalists. You know, what are your thoughts seeing that the attacks haven't stopped?
Well, it seems pretty clear that Donald Trump sees this as a way to rally his base. I mean, if you think about presidents when they go into reelection, they talk about, you know, what are their wins? What have they succeeded at as presidents? Donald Trump has failed miserably in just about everything he's tried to do as a president. The economy, we're heading to a recession. We're heading to innumerable wars. Climate change is bad. You know, a lot of people are losing their jobs. Factories are closing. But what Donald Trump has succeeded in doing is he has made white power and white supremacy the most important thing going on in Washington. He has fed his base. That is a win for him. And so he is leaning into that heading into reelection. He is going to get his base to rally behind them because they know that he has their back. Because what he is purporting, what he is championing is white supremacy. And he is going to get a white supremacy vote. And he knows that. That has been the base that has never left his back. They've never left his side. And they are going to stick with him. So he's leaning into it. So he is going to call out Don Lemon, Elijah Cummings. He's going to call out AOC. He's going to call out every African-American he can. Because he knows that that has been a winning formula for him.
All right, David, we have to take a break. But you're going to stay with us, right?
Of course.
Okay, so we'll be right back with more David Dennis Jr., more JR. Right after the break. Stay with us.
Do not take off.
Shut up and give me that and I'll sign it.
Step out.
No.
We're beyond that.
Do you want me to
step out?
That is a 65-year-old woman who ended up arrested and in jail after a confrontation. You see it there with police officers. It started with a simple broken taillight. I want to show you exactly how this started, and we want to talk about how we got to this place. But first, just quick thoughts. David Dennis Jr., senior culture editor of News One, he's here with us. Had you seen this video, David?
Yeah, I've seen the video. It went viral. There was a lot of jokes and laughter about what eventually would happen to the woman. So this has been all over the internet.
Yeah, okay, so let's get to the beginning of this, because this did, as I mentioned, begin with a broken taillight. This is why she was pulled over, an $80 ticket. Take a look.
Well, I did issue for a defective equipment. It's $80. You have till September 16th to take care of this. Get you to sign there where the X is.
So you don't even give a warning for this?
You've been driving around for 6 months like that.
I'm truthful.
Well, I'm not going to give you a warning for something you've been driving for 6 months.
No, because I don't think that I deserve to pay $80 for something that is fixable and I can fix it.
All right.
If that's all you want
to
do.
Go ahead and step out of the car.
Why?
Because you're under arrest. Step out. Step out of the vehicle.
No, I'm not.
Step out.
No.
Step out. I'm giving you a lawful order. Step out.
Okay, so you saw the middle of this. Okay, you saw what happened right after he knocked on her window. Essentially, she drove off. So let's see how that ended, because eventually she was arrested. And this is, I think it's graphic. This is just a quick warning. Take a look.
Get out of the car! 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 Get out of the car!
You better leave me!
Put your hands behind your back!
Leave me alone!
Put your hands behind your back!
No!
Now! Your hands behind your back.
No. So here's the thing. It's a rough video to watch. Mm-hmm. It's a rough video to watch. She refused to sign the ticket for a broken taillight. The officer does have the option to arrest her for not signing a ticket over a broken taillight. But this went to And listen, there are aspects of this that are absolutely her fault. Absolutely, this she drove off, but this went to him pulling a gun, and then eventually she had to be tased because now you have to take her down. And I watching this couldn't help but feel this just felt like this just made the officer mad when she wouldn't sign the ticket. This just not signing the ticket doesn't mean that you don't get the ticket, you know. And so it doesn't mean that you didn't break the law. It doesn't get you anything. And did she have to be arrested? And you wrote something the other day about ASAP Rocky specifically, and it got a lot of attention about that on Twitter. And basically, like the gist was that, you know, we talked about this, was that in order to protect all of us, sometimes we have to protect people that it seems like don't deserve it, because rules are rules and fair is fair. And watching this, I felt like it didn't have to go to this. What were your thoughts?
Well, my initial thoughts was, you know, it reminded me of a time when I was 17 and I got pulled over for a broken taillight. The problem was my taillight was not broken. The cop did threaten to impound my car. He threatened to arrest me. He berated me for about 30 minutes before letting me go. So he was on a power trip, somewhat similar to what this police officer was on. You know, I just think that you know, you're right. When we think about excessive force and things like that, I mean, this was really sort of not necessary. However, I do think that, you know, if she were 17-year-old me, I don't think he would have pulled the taser out. I don't think I would have been alive if I'd have driven off like that. And also, I'm, you know, stuck by the fact that mysteriously his his camera happened to work. When so often, when black and brown folks are dead, those cameras somehow malfunction all the time. So it's amazing that we were able to see the entire video of this incident.
It's always tough to look at these types of videos when it's not, when the suspect in this situation doesn't fit the bill of what we a lot of times see from excessive police violence. Mm-hmm. And you see the approach and how it got to that point. And as you said, you made the comparison, which it was. I'm not sure if this popped up on my feed earlier today. There was this 21-year-old woman in Tennessee who was pulled over for an expired tag, and the cop came out. It was caught on surveillance camera. And because she went to the back of her car to look at the tag, like, oh, really, it's expired? He jumps out of the car, slams her across three other cars at a gas station, and does all this. You can't hear what was said, but you can tell it wasn't aggressive. Mm-hmm. She wasn't driving off, but guns were pulled. Seven other cop cars showed up. Her passenger was arrested for getting out of the car and trying to not even physically stop it, but talk him out of the assault. So we're faced with the problem of seeing this video and going, well, why did it take this long? But at the same time, it wasn't necessary to do this again to an older lady and tasing and
anybody. Arms behind it was a backs. Broken taillight.
There has to be other solutions.
Sorry.
I guess it's more of a statement, but I wonder what you think about that, the juxtaposition of other things that happen all the time.
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing about the police force, and which in America, the police force is really a vehicle to maintain white supremacy in this country. They are used to incarcerate black people, to kill black people, to arrest, to intimidate. And the question is, how many of these white victims is America going to allow before it really does anything? Are all these white victims considered acceptable, you know, damage, right, as long as white supremacy is maintained by these police forces? And what we've learned is that there really is no number. There is an infinite amount, seemingly, of white victims like this lady in Oklahoma who are allowable as long as the main goal of these police forces, which is, arresting, intimidating black folks, as long as they're able to do that, we can sacrifice a few white lives, a few of these people can get tased, and a few of these videos can go viral, as long as the central goal is still there.
All right, so speaking of policing, and not even, this is a prosecution, so more so this one, so I just want to touch on this really quick. Another story, a little boy in Canton, Michigan was charged with assault after a dodgeball game. He's 10 years old, he's a little black boy. The little boy who was hurt was white. He was hit with a ball in the face, which happens a lot during dodgeball. He was initially charged with assault. And his mother spoke out and said that the charges were dropped. The charges have recently been dropped. The prosecutor dropped the charges. But this story went viral. I'm sure you saw the story, but the story went viral, and a lot of people were talking about, you know, the racial implications for why a 10-year-old would be charged with assault after a dodgeball game. So the prosecutor came out and said that, you know, any, you know, talk of racism is unfounded and saying, you know, that that's unfair. The little boy's mother came out and said, had this story not gone viral, her son, she believed, would still be dealing with these charges. And she specifically said, you know, my son is not a criminal. If every child that played a game of dodgeball and threw a dodgeball at another kid was thrown in jail, the vast majority of our country would be behind bars. The only thing my son is guilty of is being a black boy. And I'm sitting here with two fathers who have black sons who throw balls, right? I mean, what were your thoughts, both of you?
Well, you know, what we know historically in this country is that there is a belief that black boys and girls have supernatural abilities, right? That they can do things that their white counterparts can do. We saw that with Mike Brown, the belief that he was this hulking figure who could walk through gunshots and rip police cars off the hinges, police doors off the hinges. We saw that with Tamir Rice, with the belief that he was an 18-year-old young man when he was just 13. Or we look at Trayvon Martin, the idea that he could overpower George Zimmerman and beat him up, and that George Zimmerman needed self-defense. And so this carries on into our schools. We look at a 10-year-old black boy playing dodgeball, and the fact that he hit a kid in the face now becomes something that is assault, right? And so as a result, this kid is going through the carceral system, and money is being used to prosecute him, to throw this case out. These are resources that, might I add, a few miles up the road, Flint still does not have clean water. So all of this is sort of what happens when you have black boys and girls just trying to live their lives in school.
Right, as Brooke, as you mentioned, this is something that that the mother said only came to attention because it went viral. So this is one of those sample sizes. When people say, hey, you're just talking about these small instances that happen, this is an indication of what happens on a larger scale that most people won't hear about. It. The things that don't go viral are the things that happen every day. And even ones that don't get charged or just get shamed or punished by the school, what happens is these kids grow up with this sense of, I need to be careful of the normal things I do every day in life, or else I might be in trouble for just breathing. So you walk through on pins and needles for your life. And it's unfair.
All right, David Dennis Jr., I'm so glad to have you here. This was great having you here for this long. Thank you so much. Hope to have you back soon to talk more about everything going on. Thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, I'm going to try to break this down really quickly. The Trump administration just essentially tightened asylum rules again. The effort proceeds along two main fronts: a long-range push to narrow access to the U.S. asylum system for migrants seeking protection, and a more immediate attempt to create new deterrence by enlisting foreign governments instead of congressional Democrats. And Trump also wants help, again, from foreign countries in order to deter immigration. Late Friday, the administration announced a major new migration accord with Guatemala that would make the country a faraway repository for asylum seekers from other nations. It has been rolled out so hastily that U.S. lawmakers have yet to receive a copy. And you'll know last week, a federal judge actually, I guess, struck down Trump's attempt to deny asylum to asylum seekers who hadn't already essentially asked for it in a country they may have passed through on their way to the U.S. And I think when that came out, everyone was like, that's against international law.
If you're a full country way, then they're trying to find ways to crack down things. We've seen this administration talk about how asylum seekers are all a scam. They see attorneys and it's going to happen. Direct Donald Trump said it. Stephen Miller is always talking about how our immigration system, even legally, is broken. We got to limit it and shut it all down. This is another aspect of how they're going to approach a shutdown immigration. You lump everyone together, call everyone illegal immigrants, and then make sure no matter what the reasoning is behind what the migrants are moving for, it's all nefarious and out to hurt you. This is just another way now to back with Barr, now with his head of his Department of Justice, to pull off another way to do this.
Also, and we have to stop conflating immigration with a person seeking asylum. They're two different things. And I think this administration is trying to like flip back and forth and use them interchangeably on purpose.
Yep.
And that's a problem.
The confusion works.
Absolutely.
As long as there's hate and confusion, you can have people on your side.
Okay, so that's our time. Where'd she go? This was so much fun. I like when we get to do this together. John doesn't share us.
He didn't want to see that happen.
All right, thanks for joining us on the Damage Report. Like I said, John Iadarola is coming back Monday. You've got me and Brett hanging out with you tomorrow, though.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, going to be a lot of fun. Thanks for watching.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Iadarola. I'll see you soon.